Vishnubhadaya Krishna Sangudale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Kanamane Namaste Sarasvati Gaurabhana Vishwane Vishesha Shrimad Radhe Paskata Adhesha Hare Krishna. We try to limit our speakers to about 5 minutes apiece, but if you'll indulge me a little bit extra minutes, I'd like to just give a little bit of setting for our glorious event today of the disappearance of Srila Prabhupada. I'd like to begin by reading what Srila Prabhupada spoke during the disappearance of his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj. Prabhupada said, "Just like the sun is in the sky, but we see in the morning it appears, in the evening it retires. That is the defect of our eyes. Actually, the sun is always there. So similarly, a Vaishnav, as Krishna comes, yada yada dharmasya glanir. Similarly, a Vaishnav means the confidential servant of Krishna. He also comes for some purpose by the order of the master. So their life, Krishna's life, it is the same. There is no question of past, present, future, nityam. So they are the same thing as the appearance and disappearance of the sun. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, our master, spiritual master, he also came to this world to execute some mission of life or mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he executed it, and when it was required, he left this place and went to another place to do the same business. Just like the sun rises at 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock, there's a 6 o'clock in another place, and it's 8 o'clock in another place. It is going on Nitya Lila. So we have nothing to lament for disappearance." So, of course, we can see that these same words that our Srila Prabhupada spoke to about his spiritual master certainly apply to Srila Prabhupada. He said we had nothing to lament for disappearance. And in a philosophical sense, of course, that is absolutely true. But at the same time, it's natural for us to feel a little bit of sadness, a sense of separation from Srila Prabhupada. This is a very natural and normal feeling for the disciples. Those of us who were there in 1977 certainly remember how we felt when we heard the news that Srila Prabhupada has left us. So while we may intellectually understand this is a glorious event, appearance and disappearance are the same, in our hearts it was very difficult at that moment to feel that, because there is a sense of loss when the guru leaves us. But today, we tend to focus more not so much on the loss. Oh, we may also do that, but more on a glorification of Srila Prabhupada, an understanding of what he meant to us. And we want to relish pastimes, instructions, realizations, the teachings of Srila Prabhupada that so many devotees in this community will be presented. So we understand the historical importance of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada's physical presence while he was here on this planet, his vapu, as well as his words and instructions, the vani, changed our world. He established the Krishna consciousness movement in this Western world. We could go on for hours about that. I think we understand that. And not only historically, but in the present, many or most of us feel Srila Prabhupada's presence. We feel his ongoing inspiration. We feel that we have direction in our lives due to his ongoing presence in our Krishna conscious movement and in our own lives. But today I wanted to say a few words about the future, about how Srila Prabhupada impacts the future, not only of our movement, but of the world. Only about a week ago, I was in India for our GBC meetings. And we had a joint meeting with the ISKCON Indian Bureau, which is about 25 of the senior leading devotees who basically manage all of India. And one of the topics that they brought to us was quite interesting, because it had to do with the position of Srila Prabhupada. And they were making some proposals about, should we have some special ceremony, some special acknowledgement when a new devotee comes to Krishna consciousness? In other words, not only do they have a relationship with the Diksha Guru that they are taking, but they also have an ongoing relationship with Srila Prabhupada as well. Well, that was about a full-day discussion, and it's an ongoing discussion. We didn't come to an exact conclusion, but we all felt that this was something very important, that every devotee has a direct relationship with Srila Prabhupada, and every devotee can appreciate and understand Srila Prabhupada, whether you're second generation, third generation, fourth generation, or 500 years from today. But I was also thinking that our worship of Srila Prabhupada has to be more than a ceremony, that we just establish some ceremony, okay, here you're acknowledging Prabhupada, or some customary obligation, but that each generation of devotees in our International Society for Krishna Consciousness and all members of the Hare Krishna movement throughout the world have a deep understanding of Srila Prabhupada, of who he was and what he gave us and what his ongoing legacy will be. This reminded me that I gave a much longer presentation once here in the Temple Room a couple of years ago about a presentation that our organizational development of the GBC had put together called The Four Generations. And it's a very fascinating, interesting way of looking at our movement and our future, which I probably should present again. But what it actually says is there's a loss as we go from one generation to another. Prabhupada gave us instructions, but he also gave us a context for those instructions, and Prabhupada had an intent, a meaning that he was conveying with those instructions. For instance, take book distribution. Prabhupada was given a clear instruction from his guru, if you have any money, print books, so many instructions like that. He clearly gave that instruction to us. He went, you know, he was translating, showing by his example, he was telling us to go out and distribute books. But there was also a context, the context of the Western world, of time, place, and circumstance, of how Krishna consciousness might be slightly uniquely presented in the Western world to Western people. So it was not, there was just a pure instruction, but then there was also the context for that instruction. And then there was Prabhupada's intent, his meaning, his clear intention in achieving a preaching movement that would spread all over the world. So he had a vision to bring Krishna consciousness to the world, and one of those methods and means was the mass distribution of books. So we can see this very clearly. Prabhupada is considered first generation in this particular scheme. He's the founder. And so he had clear instruction, clear context, and clear intent. The next generation, which is us, his direct disciples, sometimes lose the intent. And we can see that by why is it that you take 10 Srila Prabhupada disciples together in the room and you take one major issue of policy and they all have a different opinion. And they've all heard Srila Prabhupada, we've all read Srila Prabhupada's books, but we're not always completely clear or agreed upon what was Srila Prabhupada's actual intention. Now, if Srila Prabhupada were here with us, he would tell us. Right? It'd be clear. Okay, that's what Prabhupada wants, we all accept. But it's not quite so clear now without Srila Prabhupada all the time. Now, the next generation down will sometimes lose the context as well as the intent. Because we might have an instruction, but we don't know exactly what it meant, where it fit in, because the next generation wasn't really there when Srila Prabhupada gave those instructions. And the fourth generation sometimes is not even clear on the instruction. By the way, this is based upon a sociological model of a study of religious organizations, you know, by a religious sociologist. In other words, this isn't something we're just making up. This was something that was studied on the Christian church and many other churches, that there's this natural progression that happens, and we see it in our own movement. For instance, let's take an example. Srila Prabhupada wrote a letter to a devotee. I was there. The devotee showed me the letter where Srila Prabhupada told this devotee that he could get divorced. Okay, so here we have an instruction. Prabhupada said it's okay to get divorced. But no, you have to know the context and the intent, or it doesn't mean anything. I mean, it doesn't give us the proper meaning. The context was this devotee had already left his wife, was already taken up with another woman. He was intent on doing this, and kind of after the fact, he presented, is this okay to Srila Prabhupada? And what was the intent? I happen to know the intent because Srila Kirti was the secretary at the time, my friend, and I asked him about this, and he told me kind of the backstory. And that was that Srila Prabhupada, because Srila Kirti went to Prabhupada and said, well, he was like dictating a letter, or somebody says, well, how can we say this? We don't believe in divorce. And Prabhupada said, he will do it anyway. And if he does it, he'll be, and I tell him not to, he'll be disobeying the orders of the spiritual master, and his spiritual life will be finished. So I have to give permission. So what do we understand of Prophet's intent? Prophet's intent was to preserve the spiritual life of his disciple. That was foremost. You know, he could clarify the instructions more, you know, and he did in many ways. If you read his books, it's very clear. But in that particular circumstance, that you have to know the context and the intent of Srila Prabhupada to completely understand the instruction. So when the spiritual master is gone, when the founder is not directly present, the intent may be lost. And we need to reconstruct that intent by understanding context and instructions. In other words, we have to know why did Prabhupada say what he did. We have to go, you know, a little bit beyond sometimes. I mean, of course, many times the instructions are very clear. In Srila Prabhupada's books, you know, he'll repeat a certain instruction 50, 100, 1,000 times. We all know it's very clear. But sometimes in these specific cases, we need to know. Then the next generation may be missing the context and the intent. So how does the next generation, who was not present when Srila Prabhupada was on this planet, understand these things? Well, one, of course, is by reading Srila Prabhupada's books, learning about his instructions, hearing the tapes, but also hearing and associating with Prabhupada's disciples to learn about what the context and the intent of Srila Prabhupada was to the degree that we understand it. And then, of course, the fourth generation may even start losing the instructions. And the remedy for that is that they need to be reconstructed by relevant systems of education. Prabhupada gave us his books, his lectures, his words, his memories, so many things. And so younger generations have to be reading Srila Prabhupada's books, have to be in connection with his instructions, or the spiral continues and things became changed and lost. So today we will hear many remembrances. I was thinking about, you've already heard mine. I have a few stories and I probably repeated them several times over the last 12 years, so I won't do that today. I'll let you hear from others. And as we hear these instructions of Prabhupada, realizations, and remembrances, they're not only very enlivening to us and they give us a sense of being with Prabhupada, but they also an opportunity to hear about Srila Prabhupada, to understand Srila Prabhupada, to understand his instructions and the context and the intent of what Srila Prabhupada was giving us. So today it's a great opportunity to give thanks to Prabhupada of what he has given us, to deeply reflect upon him, reflect on our relationship with him, our memories of him, but also to understand his mission, his instructions, his intention and meaning. And then we can better apply how Srila Prabhupada is meaningful in our life and how he is present and how he is continuing to guide us for many, many generations. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Srinath Damodar Maharaj, followed by Mukhya Devi Dasi. Thank you. ॐ यमितमरन्धस्य जनञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुमिलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः. हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे. इट्स द डिवाइन ग्रेस, श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय. आई हैव अ व्यासा पूजा होमेज, आई गेस दैट इज मोर फॉर व्यासा पूजा डे, आई डोंट हैव इट विद मी, सो could be a blessing in disguise because I'm just going to have to spontaneously maybe share, I hope it's nectar, of some encounters I had with Srila Prabhupada. One thing I just about the sociologist, Damodar Prabhu, is kind of warning us that there's this tendency in the material world for each generation in a religion to lose, I guess we also hear about mission drift or something like that. But I just want to express my gratitude to Ranjit Prabhu and others in the Bhaktivedanta archives that we have a tremendous resource. So at least we can say there's no good excuse for like the future generation. Well, it says the sociologist said we're supposed to forget. No, you have all the resources and the proof of Prabhupada's magnificent activities in this world. Sometimes Christians, not even Christians, they're such revisionists that sometimes books coming out questioning the historical authenticity, they say, well, actually, there was no Jesus Christ. He just made it up. But and Prabhupada, just like Jesus Christ, Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta said, he's Shaktivesh Avatar. He said, I don't say. Guru Maharaj said. So Shaktivesh Avatar. We never criticize Jesus Christ. Shaktivesh Avatar. So the authenticity, I mean, the reality, even in this material world, that Prabhupada did what he did. He actually was able to do these amazing feats. Even in Encyclopedia Britannica, I bought a set in, was it about 73 or so? And I never really read it, the whole set of books. It was expert. He should have been an ISKCON book distributor. He knocked on the door and he actually sold me a set, gave me easy payment plan and all that. And the only thing I ever looked in that whole set of Encyclopedia Britannica is I went to pee to look at Prabhupada. And he said he astounded the world by he astonished everyone by translating more Vedic literatures than anyone has ever done before. I guess what applies to me, I mean, to bring it to my own experience with Srila Prabhupada, is that we're dealing with, I mean, first of all, Prabhupada's not God, okay? He's not, we know that. Devotees try to say, you know, he's so great, he's actually Krishna or something, and Prabhupada never got more angry than he did when devotees said that. That was in New Vrindavan. And, was it 70, 71, something? That's history. So we don't go that. We don't go in that there. We know that's not the deal, despite the fact of him being a direct representative. But I don't know how much greater anyone could be than Srila Prabhupada without being God. I mean, really. I mean, we're dealing, and as the years go by, it just, I know this may sound like an inappropriate example, but, you know, you have these wine cellars, and, you know, like you say you can find a bottle of wine, and it costs $50,000 for this bottle of wine, and it's, what, it's like 45 years old or something like that. And people, you know, the connoisseurs will say, this is really, so as our appreciation of Srila Prabhupada as the years go by should be, in my case, I'm happy to say that it is actually increasing. And I hear, I'm listening nowadays to the Amala Bhakti's recording of the, he only gave us the recording of the fifth volume of Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita, the whole struggle in Bombay and Prabhupada's determination. Where all this is going is that just as Krishna is all great, Srila Prabhupada is all great. Not that he's Krishna, but he's all great in the sense that the scope of his greatness covers everything. I mean, I didn't experience Prabhupada as exactly as a Sankirtan soldier, as the general, as he stepped forward and led the battle in various fronts, but especially that Bombay challenge was so archetypical of Srila Prabhupada's amazing, you could say, Kshatriya attitude. He wasn't Kshatriya, but he had that when needed. He could lead the fight. Even the disciples couldn't understand, why is Srila Prabhupada so anxious to get this land? This land is useless. Why is he so anxious? They couldn't understand his intention. So that I did not that was not my experience. My experience, except for one darshan in 1971, it must have been in Boston, I got special mercy from the devotees, even though I was a nobody, but because I had encounters with Srila Prabhupada at the beginning, they made a special arrangement that I could have darshan. But in 1966, that was a wild and special time, window to the spiritual world. It's a window of opportunity, you can say. It was really, really a very unusual time, and that's when Prabhupada began the mission in the Western world. And I don't have time to really go into details of my encounters, but I was a little like that drunk, except instead of alcohol, it was LSD, which in some ways is even worse because it's more unpredictable. Don't worry, the whole talk is not about old wine and getting drunk. I don't know, I'm getting into the, so I'm still in Tamagoon. But Prabhupada, I wasn't the only one. In 1971, when I had that sort of follow-up darshan with Prabhupada, I became slightly sane by that time. Slightly. And I tried to identify. I was very concerned that Prabhupada would remember me from our talks in 1966. And they kind of gave him a miscue. They said that I was in 61 Second Avenue, and I never was there. I had become sort of turned into a vegetable for a while. Then I ran off to the woods in Vermont, so I kind of had some time away from association for some months. But I was nervous, and I couldn't correct. So I wanted to somehow give Prabhupada a hint of our encounters. So I told him, Srila Prabhupada, when I used to speak with you in 1966, I was very crazy. You know, as if I were the only one. But I was, you know, maybe notably, you know, I was pretty bad. So, Prabhupada, I've mentioned this many times, but Srila Prabhupada raised his eyebrows and he looked at me and he right in the eye and he said, "Oh, are you still crazy?" Prabhupada had quite a sense of humor. He said it in just the way, if you are a crazy person and you want to provoke his craziness and trigger some sort of acting out on his part or something, that's just the way to do it, you know. And I immediately, "No, Srila Prabhupada, I'm not crazy." You know? Anyway, I there was more to that darshan. But in 1966, I was quite out of order. We read in that famous incident where the drunk came in and he just started, you know, yelling completely incoherent. You know, he was like really drunk. And right in the middle of the class, and then he had some paper products and he put them down. Then he went out. He said, "I'm coming back." And maybe the boys were thinking, "Oh no!" And he did come back, and he immediately placed rolls of toilet paper and paper towels in different strategic locations in the temple. And he kind of careened out, and Prabhupada was smiling ear to ear. He said, "Just see, he has begun his devotional service." And it's very, I guess I had an experience like that where I was very, I don't have much time, but I was very puffed up. That's really being very euphemistic. Many of the hippies on LSD, there's something called the messianic complex. Well, you think you're the Messiah, or you think you're better than the Messiah, that you're the, you know, the big boss, or something like that. So I didn't know. I thought I was somebody. I thought it definitely was up there. So my general tendency was not to offer obeisances, although I did them sometimes, but in 66, not too much. And my tendency was to, I'd sit and I would accept the kirtan. You know, I thought the kirtan was for me. So My tendency wasn't so much to serve, but to come and just experience and maybe give my mercy to everybody, or something like that. So There was this one time where I became a little bit down to earth, a little bit. And I kind of caught on that the name of the game is to do some service for the Swami. That was in 60. It was like a club. I mean, that was kind of what it was, what the hippies kind of caught on at a certain point, that you were supposed to offer some service. So I came sauntering in to Prabhupada's apartment. He said, "Swamiji, I'm willing to help out." Something, I mean, it's God's gift to the world, you know. It was like about as humble as, you know, as, I won't mention names. I don't want to get political now. So it wasn't very humble at all. And Srila Prabhupada, see, this is the point I'm making, that the aspect or the facet of Srila Prabhupada's greatness that I had realization of and experience of was that titikshashva karunika, the idea of being merciful. And how could you be merciful if you're not tolerant? You see, so he was so tolerant and therefore able to deliver the mercy in such huge doses. I mean, real quick, when I showed up and 3 more minutes, is it? I'll be honest. I'll be real about it. It's 8:35. 3 minutes? How many say okay? Is there 3 minutes? That's not much time. Many of you heard this incident where it's an example of that tolerance and mercy. When I showed up in the middle of a Bhagavatam class, it was a little earlier in those days, like 6:30 or something. I was up all night, quote, doing my thing, whatever that was, just going, you know, just interacting with other people, tripping and all that. I just came in the temple and I had my fur coat and my long hairs and all this stuff, and my vibration was strange. And I showed up at the door during the class, and Prabhupada stopped the class and he looked at me at the door and he said, "Lan," he knew my name, he knew my given name, "Lan, did you take LSD?" So I was like, "No, Swamiji." Now, I wasn't exactly lying. The problem was I'd taken it a few days earlier, but it was an overdose. And I was very susceptible because of being neurotic. And so he could see that, you know, he already had some experience with me, and didn't want me to, like, disrupt the class, like, completely. He was willing to let me disrupt it a little. That's the tolerance and the patience. If it were almost anyone else, get that guy out of here. I already know what he's capable of doing. He can't come in. Let him at least come down from his LSD. No, Prabhupada just watched me as I slowly stepped forward. And because I was still under the influence, for me, the floor was moving like kind of up and down or something, you know. That was my experience. So I was walking in a sort of strange way to try to deal with the moving floor that I thought was happening. And I just parked myself right in front of Srila Prabhupada and his lotus feet. And the class went on. And that's one of the reasons I'm here today. Because he was patient. He knew how to draw the line. But that one, especially in 66, it was the bar was low, lower the bar. I mean, it was really hard to get dismissed and rejected by Prabhupada. You really had to be bad. I mean, big time bad. So anyway, that's what I wanted to share. There are various other incidents where I came in and was totally out of order, and Srila Prabhupada was so aristocratic and elegant and opulent and patient and loving and tolerant and so merciful. Thank you for letting me share this. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Namukya, and then Shruti Rupa will be next. Thank you.
Jai Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So I was in Vrindavan in September, and the end of my month-long trip, and I finished reading Vishakha's book when I was there. It was so moving reading about Srila Prabhupada's departure, and when I read this book, I've never felt so present in a story as I have when I read this particular book. And there we were at the end of Prabhupada's life, this book ends, and I really felt so present at that moment. So I, you know, on this particular day where we remember Prabhupada in many ways, I sort of like to go back to that feeling of how it was when Prabhupada departed and how sort of bereft we all felt. And this book really put it beautifully. So I wanted to read it, but I wanted to advocate for all of these books that devotees have written about their experiences with Prabhupada. I was talking to a devotee once, just saying how much I had enjoyed one of, I'd read them all, and I was speaking about one of them with him, and he said, "Oh, I only read books that Prabhupada wrote." And I thought that's, you know, that's kind of admirable, but at the same time, these books that the devotees have written about their experience with Prabhupada are full of Bhaktivedanta purports. And they are the purport of Bhaktivedanta at the same time. It's important to really have that personal understanding of what Prabhupada had to work with when he started in this country and what he created with what he had to work with. It's really quite amazing, and it helps you see more, not just, you know, your own personal relationship with Prabhupada, but the relationship Prabhupada had with all of humankind, how important that is, what he's done and who he really is. I see that devotees can get caught up in minutiae, you know, are we ascending or descending, or they rather than see really who is Prabhupada and what has he done, and you know, what's he doing for all of humanity. That is something that can't be had anywhere else in any other religion, any other group, any other movement. You know, there's the express train is on his track, and you can be on that train if you stay on his track. And one way to do that is to understand and appreciate him as a person, and you can do that through reading some of these books, all of these books. I've never found one that it didn't inspire me. So anyway, I'm going to read this part that will be my what I speak today. Although Prabhupada's voice was a whisper and his prone body covered with a white sheet was, in his own words, a bag of bones, Prajumna knelt by the side of his bed, read the Sanskrit text of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and Prabhupada continued to translate and comment. Other disciples huddled around the bed in a scene reminiscent of one in the Bhagavatam, where Grandfather Bhishma, lying on his deathbed and surrounded by his well-wishers, relatives, and heirs to the kingdom, used his final breaths to offer valuable knowledge, invaluable knowledge. Yadavar repeatedly asked permission to film Prabhupada translating, but Tamal Krishna Goswami, Prabhupada's secretary, was hesitant. He remembered how the bright lights had disturbed Prabhupada in Denver and thought that, especially in Prabhupada's present condition, the lights in our presence would again be taxing. On October 21st, Prabhupada, laying motionless, conversed with Tamal Krishna Goswami. So he said, "Yadavar wants to film you translating. Is that all right? You don't mind. We can have a little light here while he films for about half a minute. It won't disturb you." And Prabhupada said, "Yadavar is a good devotee." And Tamal Krishna said, "Yadavar is a good devotee, very dedicated devotee. You remember he cooked bhati chachuri very nice for you. He was cooking for you in Rishikesh, massaging. He's very intelligent." Prabhupada said, "Yes." He said, Tamal Krishna said, "His wife is also intelligent, Vishakha." Prabhupada said, "Yadavar has become a devotee first." And Tamal Krishna said, "He has become a devotee first, Prabhupada? First a devotee before his wife." And Tamal Krishna said, "Yes, first devotee before wife. Yes, you convinced him. He did not come here thinking to become a devotee. Remember, he came for photography work." "Yes, but his good fortune was that he chose to photograph you, Prabhupada, and the devotees." And Prabhupada said, "Yadavar has freedom." And Tamal Krishna said, "What, Prabhupada?" "Yadavar has freedom to do anything." "Yadavar has freedom to do anything?" The controller. Prabhupada said, And Tamakrishna said, "I think that will make his service very enhanced to know that." Yadavar and I sat at the foot of Prabhupada's large bed, becoming part of a cheerless scene, filming, recording, and photographing as Prabhupada used his last bit of energy to continue his lifelong devotional service, translating and commenting on the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. At this point, the purport to the 10th canto, chapter 13, The Stealing of the Boys and Calves by Brahma, text 53. His words were slightly slurred and followed one another slowly, yet the content was cogent and pristine. Knowledge that reached out to us longingly and hauntingly, enveloping and transporting us to another world of awareness. This is a quote from his purport. One should understand that no one is independent, for everything is part and parcel of Krishna and is acting and moving by the supreme desire of Krishna. This understanding, this consciousness, is Krishna consciousness. Such simple words expressing the deepest wisdom spoken in such dire circumstances went directly from Prabhupada's mouth into my headphones and vibrated in my ears. They at once transcended time and place and yet were utterly applicable to time and place. But I was unable to relate to them or to relate them to the situation. I could not understand that Prabhupada's heartbreakingly dwindled condition was the supreme desire of Krishna, that our recording one of his final purports was also the supreme desire of Krishna, and that his passing from this world would be also the supreme desire of Krishna. Yet death, like life, was Krishna. Prabhupada was in Krishna's grip. Even now, theirs was a relationship of love. I was an onlooker who failed to grasp the intimacy and sweetness of that relationship. Nearing the end of his long and active life, Prabhupada entered a period of reflection and judged his students' conduct differently. Words of appreciation and encouragement replaced reprimands. And Prabhupada also made unforgettable statements, as when he said to a senior student, "Don't think this won't happen to you." When Jayadwaita commented on the astonishing number of books Prabhupada had translated while he was traveling, opening centers, instructing, initiating, writing thousands of letters, managing, meeting people, and so on, Prabhupada said, "A little water wears the stone." To write daily was to eventually write volumes. On November 11th, the day of the great festival of Govardhan Puja, Prabhupada asked to be taken by bullock cart on the 14-mile path around Govardhan Hill. His Ayurvedic doctor said the bumpy ride would be bad for him. Devotees were divided. Some said if Prabhupada wanted to go, he should go. Others said such a trip would preclude any chance of recovery, and worse, that Prabhupada would die from it. And Prabhupada didn't go. On the 14th of November, 1977, my god sisters and I were having lunch when we heard the doctor's diagnosis. Prabhupada had 5 hours left. We went to Prabhupada's room, surrounded his bed, and joined the kirtan, now one of distraught, raw emotion. Prabhupada's face was simply skin, wrapped around bone and cartilage. Gone were his sobering and penetrating looks. Gone were his myriad expressions of love, devotion, patience, disapproval, humor, compassion, and liveliness. Gone were his expressive aristocratic gestures. As he awaited the final moment, his eyes were closed, his breathing unnoticeable. He was suspended in time, beyond everything in time, meditative, indrawn, and calm. In contrast, passion swelled and reeled around him. Stationed at the head of the bed, a Bengali disciple, Bhakti Churu Swami, who had been too distracted to shave for several days, periodically poured a few drops of Yamuna water from a tiny silver pitcher into Prabhupada's slightly open mouth. Prabhupada's sister, Pishima, grave and downcast, sat on the floor near Bhakti Churu Swami. Our ever-well-wisher, our source of knowledge and guidance, of comfort and security and protection, of balance and maturity and enthusiasm, that person who was the focal point of our affection was departing. What could be said? What was left to say? Prabhupada, withdrawing deep within himself, was leaving his body, us, the Krishna Balaram temple, the earth planet, and the mundane world altogether. At first hourly and then minute by minute, the intensity of the devotee's agony increased, filling every crevice of the room. Where there was great love, there was also miracles. The devotee's crying, wailing, bewilderment, moroseness, devastation, and above all, chanting of God's names, expressed the extraordinary devotion that Prabhupada had aroused in them, young and old, men and women of every nationality and denomination. Standing on chairs next to each other at the foot of Prabhupada's bed, Yadavar filmed and I photographed and recorded. Since the time I'd frozen when Prabhupada danced at the Delhi Pandal, I had learned to immunize myself emotionally from any situation so that I could continue my service, and somehow that immunization remained strong. I shelved my feelings, and Yadavar did the same. Devotees massaged Prabhupada's feet and stroked his arms. Long-faced sannyasis looked at him fixedly. Occasionally, the doctor checked Prabhupada's pulse. The air thickened with despair. At 7:24 p.m., the tumultuous emotion and chanting reached a climax, like the genuine crying of children for their father, and Prabhupada passed away. We were all asked to leave Prabhupada's room so his body could be bathed and dressed. When we had entered Prabhupada's quarters, it had been bright outside. When we left, night had settled in. We filed into the temple room, and soon devotees put Prabhupada's body on his raised seat. Until his body was interred, which would be 12 hours later, it was ceremoniously honored as it had housed a holy person of the highest caliber. With a voice of divine yearning, Prabhupada's godbrother, Krishnadas Babaji, sang a traditional song of separation in which the songwriter, Narottam Das Thakur, laments for the exalted persons who have passed on. He who brought the treasure of divine love and who is filled with compassion and mercy, where has such a personality gone? I will smash my head against the rock and enter into the fire. Where will I find that person who is the reservoir of all wonderful qualities? Being unable to obtain the association of such a devotee, Narottam Das simply weeps. Although I continued to record and photograph, part of me was in shock. It was irrational, but I never actually believed that Prabhupada would or could leave us. His limp form sitting before me was present yet inconceivable. I saw it, yet didn't see it. For me, by dint of his staunch conviction, Prabhupada had always been ageless, or rather he was forever 75, the same age as when I'd met him. A world without precious and relishable moments with him, without his endless, ever-fresh talk of Krishna, without his majestic radiance that evoked love and reverence, without his singing, his instructions, his awesome encouragement, his resounding devotional service, his all-around awareness, his brisk morning walks along beaches and through parks, this would be a world of impossible intrusive darkness. Throughout the night, devotees sang to Prabhupada's slumped form, and the next morning, with Prabhupada's body on a palanquin carried by his strong disciples, we went in a kirtan procession to the seven major temples of Vrindavan. Local residents lined the streets to offer their last respects along with garlands, food, and money to the great departed soul. Many gently touched Prabhupada's transcendental form and then touched their foreheads to procure his blessings. And then she just proceeds to tell what happened as they put Prabhupada into his samadhi. Anyway, sometimes you have to remember that to, you know, remember the full impact of who Prabhupada is, what he's done, and what he continues to do for all of us and for everyone that is touched by his mercy. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
So now, Shruti Rupa followed by Kalyapani Prabhu.
Hey Krishna. Well, thank you, Tamahara Prabhu, for giving us a way forward and reminding us of Prabhupada's with us. And Maharaj for reminding us of Prabhupada's kindness and causeless mercy. I was a little hesitant because I move into separation. And so, Mukhya, thank you for giving me that entry. So I'm going to pick up where Mukhya took us. So actually, I've written something. I've been thinking about it for this last year, 40 years, which is actually two generations. I think a generation is considered 20 years. So that means I was like 23 when Prabhupada left. So I began writing this for Prabhupada actually about a year ago, and it's titled 40 Years of Separation. Dear Srila Prabhupada, 40 long years have gone by since I was in your personal presence and service. I'm still here, but I do not know how I've gone on. I've been going through the motions, but I have felt lost without your presence. Others go on and follow your instructions with great care and devotion, and they accept what is favorable for your service and reject what is not. I, on the other hand, feel as though I'm a black sheep among your disciples, for I feel so alone and without enthusiasm or service, simply making a show of attachment without taking seriously to the process you have given. Srila Prabhupada, when you left, I felt as though I'd lost everything I cherished, and all purpose and direction. It was so confusing that I became absorbed in insignificant personal goals, which only brought me pain and betrayed me. If I stayed true to the promises I made you, perhaps I'd be free of this lamentation. But now, after so much heartache and loss, I have no taste left for this world, yet I'm so unfortunate that I have no strength or determination to move forward. Punish me if you must, but teach me, show me, correct me, and allow me your mercy to serve you once again. I've seen that no one can give me shelter, protect me, or offer such happiness and kindness as you have given all of us. What will be the outcome for such an ignorant fool as myself? For will I ever find the dust of your lotus feet again? Srila Prabhupada, I pledge you this life and every life thereafter until I am fortunate enough to find your mercy once again. I am hopeful that you will not forget about me despite my unworthiness. You showed me so much kindness over the years, and once while attending the Kumbh Mela in 1977, as I was helping you into your shoes, I foolishly changed the position rather quickly. And as a result, you stepped on my hand and my arm and remained there while I reorganized your shoes with the other hand. At that moment, you removed all inauspiciousness from my life. Why did I not understand at that time? In your final months in Vrindavan, when you no longer required my services, I felt as though I could not breathe and that I no longer wanted to live. I was so brokenhearted that all I could do was cry and plead with you from within my heart to be allowed to continue serving you. I could not imagine being separated from you. When my begging and crying did not prove worthy enough, I then began to call out to Srimati Radharani, Queen of Vrindavan, and beg her to allow me to serve you, her dearmost servant. I pleaded from the depths of my soul. Then, as though a miracle had spoken, a brahmachari appeared at my door and said that Tamal Krishna Maharaj was asking to see me. When I came in to see him, he said that you had told him that you wanted to test me. And test me you did, but only by first showing me great love and kindness. You told Tamal Krishna Maharaj to tell me to prepare kachori and singara for with you within 45 minutes. He preached to me that this was the most important service in the movement at the time, for we all needed you to eat if you were to remain with us. After I completed the test in the time you had requested, Bhakti Charu Maharaj entered the kitchen and told me you were asking for me. So I came into your room and offered my obeisances. Seeing you so thin, shirtless, with bones jutting from your shoulders, your voice was so weak, my eyes filled with tears, and I inched my way forward until I was inches from you in order to hear your voice. With singara in your hand, you looked into my eyes, and with barely a voice you said, I have not eaten anything solid in 2 weeks. And you saw the tears in my eyes, so with your big, beautiful smile, you said, but I'm eating your singara. Then you said to me so lovingly, so you can cook. And the room filled with your dear disciples roared, Jai Hari Bol. The joy was overflowing in each of us, for our prayer was that you would eat and then you would remain with us. So this pastime gave us a feeling of hope and more time with you. Then you said in a firm voice, again looking straight into my eyes, you must shop, you must cook, and you must clean, and you must have no assistance. And then you looked at all the men gathered in the room and said, no one is to be in the kitchen when she is there. And then in a loving voice you turned to me and said, is that all right? My eyes once again filled with tears. And I said, yes, of course, Srila Prabhupada. I then told you that I'd begin praying to Srimati Radharani to allow me to serve you. You immediately replied, yes, I know, as if confirming that she had spoken to you of my prayers. So you allowed me to continue to serve you, and you showed me your mercy, even though you did not require my service, for you did not have an appetite and were not eating. This was the nature of your causeless mercy, to encourage us even if it meant you served us. How fortunate we were to receive such kindness from you. This memory remains as vivid today as if the events had happened only yesterday. Srila Prabhupada, I pray that mercy you showed me then will find me again. I pray that I will once again find that mood, that intensity of purpose, that urgency to be near you and to serve you with that same intensity of feeling. I now understand and pray that the practice and the will, the patience and the determination required for success find me. Your mercy is all that I'm made of. Please give me the strength to remain steady and be able to please you. I see no other purpose in life. Although you've disappeared from my eyes, you are eternally present in your words and in my heart. Your mercy transcends this world and is active and alive for all of us. Srila Prabhupada, please guide me and show me how to hear you perfectly so that I can receive your mercy once more. I see nothing else worthwhile or appealing in this world. When I flew with you to London on your last trip in 1977, during our time at the manor, it became apparent that you would be leaving us. That was more than one could comprehend, for we were all still so young. I knew you knew my prayer to serve you closely, and I began to understand that I was forcing myself on you. By your kindness, you allowed this unworthy soul to remain near. So one day I stopped praying to be with you, and I began to pray that you would please bless me, that if I could not be with you personally, that I would always feel your presence near me. Thank you, Srila Prabhupada. By your kindness and mercy, I do feel your presence near me, and it sustains me and allows me to understand all that you've given. The years are passing. The difference between then and now is that you were always present for each of us, and you're still here for each of us today. I did not understand that then, but I understand it now. So I need to find that great intensity again, that desire where I know nothing else but you, that urgency, that sincere one-pointedness, because with these ingredients, you are present. Srila Prabhupada, I pray to perfect this life as you wished for us. And in this connection, I promise what you have given me, that I will share it with others. For you are very much alive and accessible to everyone and here with us now, and are continuing to guide and inspire us as we try to move forward. Thank you, Srila Prabhupada. I will work to bring you pleasure in serving your words and fulfilling your hopes for us, begging for your mercy.
Kalyapani Prabhu, followed by another Rangavati.
I'm going to read an offering to Srila Prabhupada, and then with Vaishnavananda Prabhu, I'd like to present a 30-second skit on a pastime of Srila Prabhupada. Dear Srila Prabhupada, please accept my most humble obeisances at your lotus feet. Approaching you has been like approaching a mountain. At first, the mountain was so distant, I hardly knew what it was. Over the years, as I grew closer, the mountain became bigger, more daunting. Now, as I reach the foothills, many varied attributes and gifts are becoming visible. When I take shelter of your slopes, I will find accommodation, nourishment, and engagement in so many ways. Sometimes I'm tempted to look elsewhere for guidance, inspiration, or even enlightenment. But again and again, I'm reminded that all perfection in all areas is available
in your waterfalls, forests, valleys, and peaks. You are a mountain range, vast and unlimited. I'd be content to find my particular grove, cave, or vale, and forget the cheap thrills on offer in the world's towns and cities, thrills that flicker and fade in the light of the fulfillment, the magnificence, and the permanence your slopes offer. Yet I am drawn onward, higher and higher. The climate, the flora and fauna, and the nature of whom I encounter all intriguingly transform. Your resounding voice invites me to ascend, promising transcendental delights not found on the plains. The way is perilous, yet success is assured. Don't attempt the journey alone. You'll fall. Your perfect words entreat. Come hand in hand, tightly knit in hearty accord with friends, associates, colleagues, and family. Ego, separatism, ambition, and fault finding, these constitute a heavy burden for the traveler. Drop them into the mountain torrents and let them be carried far away. So we progress as one body, one movement. There's no need for pretense, masks, or charades when residing on the ancient, rock-solid foundation your dells and canyons provide. You are made of integrity, sincerity, internal harmony, and total non-judgmental acceptance of every single living being who has the fortune to be drawn to your wondrous landscape. Srila Prabhupada, like the Himalayas, you are beautiful, munificent, magnificent, serene and immovable, without comparison, and giving of shelter to the world weary. You have seen everything, know everything, and stand far, far above the world of men and beasts. Yet you reach gently down to us who are helpless, delivering the Ganges waters to soothe feverish hearts. As Krishna's mystical ambassador, you provide the doorway to higher realms, a stairway to heaven. We may ever rest at your lotus feet, for you will never disappear. Kindly forgive me, chastise me, engage me and deliver me. Your fallen servant, Kalyapani Das.